Call tax committee to order. This morning, members, we have several bills on the agenda, so okay. I'm sorry here. Let's start, Mr. Wilkin. I will move House File 9. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
And are we going to do a co-presentation? I see you have, I see you have someone there to help you, Mr. Wilkin.
I'll yield to the chair of the Ways and Means Committee just in case I need that later in session.
It's really the other way around, Mr. Chair. He's here to help me.
Okay.
But, we really have two bills here, members, before us, House File 135 and House File 9, which are essentially the same bill. I think Representative Wilkin and I thought up this idea on the same day a couple of years ago. We got our bills drafted independently. We submitted them. I think they went in on the same day a couple years ago, and we're back with the same bills today because they didn't make it through the tax process last time. What both bills do is basically conform to federal law in regard to treatment of health savings accounts for purposes of Minnesota law. Allows us to have full tax deductibility of contributions to health savings accounts, allows interest, earnings, other income within health savings accounts to grow without paying taxes on it. Basically, it has the same treatment as the federal government does. And we propose this, Mr. Chairman and members, because we really see health savings accounts as one of the ways that we can really put a lid on some of the health care cost increases that we're experiencing. You know, one of the problems I see with the whole health care area is that people just don't have as much skin in the game, so to speak, as they do when they're making other purchases in life. And we need to create a situation where people have the ability to get health insurance, whereas at the same time, they have some incentive to shop around. They've got some incentive to look at how much does this procedure cost. Could I get a better quality procedure elsewhere? Is there a lower price elsewhere? Health savings accounts, by giving them their own money and creating an incentive for them to spend their own money wisely, helps to keep health care costs under control and has been proven to do so in other areas that have implemented them. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I certainly advocate for both House File 135 and House File 9 to be included in the omnibus tax bill, and I'll turn things over to Representative Wilkin.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add to Representative Knobloch's statements, what the crux here is the tax treatment on the tax-preferred account that is paired with the high-deductible health plan. And the monies in those accounts can be used for any qualified medical expense. And in your packet, you'll see there's a memo from me that kind of explains all the benefits and features of health savings accounts, and also there's some other attachments. One of those is what all can the health HSA be used for, the various medical expenses, and it can go beyond what your health insurance covers. It helps you so you don't have to worry about whether you have a mandate on your coverage or not, so that the insurance company has to pay. You have the, it empowers the consumer to use that money for whatever health expense they think is necessary, as long as it's approved by the IRS, our good friends over there. And another attachment to that is, and I think this is one of the most important features of doing state tax compliance, is the compounding effect of the money that you accumulate in your HSA account. Basically, when you choose a mutual fund, if you choose a mutual fund with a high maintenance fee, you're going to accumulate much less rapidly. And over time, the time value of money really magnifies that. So if you choose a mutual fund that has a much lower maintenance fee, you're going to accumulate much better for your retirement. Well, the same goes with health savings accounts, and you'll see a handout in your packet that kind of shows over the course of time the possible accumulation in your account that can be used for your retirement health care. That's important because this can be used to pay for long-term care expenses. This can be used to pay for your retiree health and Medicare expenses and prescription drugs. So as you accumulate over the years, you'll have money to fund that retirement health care. And once we have state tax compliance with the federal tax law, that'll help just all the more accumulate over the years. So it's important that we do this now so that the people that are accumulating these dollars can maximize those benefits. I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I plead ignorance on this. What is the difference I see here in the overview between being tax-free and not just tax-deferred? Yeah, I'm thinking it's the same. What's the difference between something being tax-free and tax-deferred?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, I guess the way I'd summarize it is if it's tax-deferred, that means you get a nice surprise when you retire and you decide to use the money, then you get a big tax hit. And Mr. Michael can correct me if I'm wrong, but if it's tax-free, you're not just deferring your tax liability until you're done with the account. It's no taxes, period.
Mr. Michael, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, I think, you know, that Representative Wilkins' description is accurate. If you think about, for example, a lot of people are familiar with deductible IRAs, 401ks, 403b, 457 plans. Those plans, when you make a contribution to them, you deduct the contribution, and the income that's earned by the account is not taxed while it's earned. But then when you take a distribution from your 401k, that is tax, that's ordinary taxable income to you. The difference with an HSA, which is why it's characterized in the summary as tax-free, which is was what Representative Wilkin is saying, you make a contribution to the HSA, it's tax-deductible, same way to the 401k plan. The interest, the investment income that it earns while the money is in the account is also not taxed, but then the key difference comes that when the distribution is made, that it's provided it's used for a qualifying purpose, it's not taxed. So it's really tax-free. This is, you know, it's some people, planners refer to this as like the triple crown of tax, you know, investing, because you got it's tax-free going in, it's tax-free while it earns, and it's tax-free when it comes out, which contrasts with the classic tax deferral schema for most retirement plans. Now, Roth IRAs are a little bit different. It's taxed when you earn it, and so it's not tax-free going in. The income is tax-exempt, and you don't ever pay tax on the distribution. So that's, again, it's the two things, but not all three, not the triple crown the way HSAs are.
Thank you.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Krenke. Pardon my ignorance on this. I don't know much about this, but one of the things that I'm questioning or wondering about to Representative Wilkin or Representative Knobloch would be on family. The way I understand this right now, I could put, under this proposal, I could put up to $4,000 in the account, which would be used as we've discussed. But what if a parent wanted to put a some or all of $4,000 into a youth into a person, into an account specifically for a youth, not for the family, because it would do the same money principle would occur, and if I was fortunate enough to be able to afford to make contributions to that over a period of time until, let's say, they were 18 or some specified age, that would have incredible growth, and when they get to be 50 or 55 or 60, they might be able to use that to pay their health premiums. That would be coming from me, but going to a benefit to an individual, you know, a child. I see family here, but I'm thinking family in the context of ongoing yearly expenses. But I'm thinking in the long term here about how you could set up a kid so that if he wanted to retire when he was 50 and didn't have any medical coverage, he'd have an annuity, so to speak, to help pay for that. What is there any opportunity in there for that type of thing, or does that exist already? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, that might get into some of the more archaic areas of IRS rulemaking, whether a minor can have an account established. I would hope so. An individual can have an account, and anybody can contribute to that on a tax-free basis. I do know that, and I don't know if there's a minimum age where, you know, it has to be over 18 or not. Maybe tax staff could help us with that. But once you establish an account, your employer can deposit tax-free, you can deposit tax-free, or anybody else. So if you decided you wanted to you like me a lot and you wanted to support my health care savings account, you could deposit in my account.
Well, Representative Chairman Craig, I was thinking more of myself than
I know Wilkin
at this time.
He doesn't like you that much, Representative Wilkin.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? The Representative Wilkin, Representative Knobloch, I presume you've looked over the Department of Revenue's information. I'm rather curious if either of you have a thought. The information that I have gained is that HSAs are quite popular and seem to be, at least in other parts of the country, a growing trend. And can you give us any insight as to why, perhaps, Representative Wilkin, you think that this doesn't show that there's an increasing amount of revenue loss under this proposal?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure I understand the question.
The revenue note shows that in the out biennium 2008-2009 that the amount of revenue loss anticipated is just slightly more than what the revenue loss is in 2007. Representative Abrams is going to answer the question for you. You lucked out. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't give you the code book when you became chair of the committee, but you have to read these revenue notes, particularly in the income tax area, a little bit differently than would be intuitive, because you pick up two tax years in FY06 because we're on a fiscal year basis rather than a calendar year basis. So the way I would read this is it's probably about 2.4 for tax year 2005, 2.8 million for tax year 2006, 3 million for tax year 2007, and going up that way. But you pick up about 2 years in the FY06 number, Mr. Chairman.
But, that's what I was going to say, Mr. Chairman.
It's good. That's good, Representative Wilkin. Glad you're welcome to the Tax Committee. Maybe we could have someone from the Department of Revenue, someone here that could explain the revenue note.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dick Gebhardt. I'm with the Department of Revenue. The explanation you heard is essentially correct. This is retroactive, and so you are picking up 2 years in the first year. And the growth then that you see in FY07 through FY09 is based on IRS tax expenditure numbers that they're expecting at the federal level ratioed back to Minnesota.
But I guess I understand looking at that information, but my question would be is that is there any information that would indicate that these HSAs are more popular than what was first anticipated either by the federal government or by states who have put this practice into their tax code?
Mr. Chairman, actually based on the latest information we have from the Joint Committee on taxes, they appear to be a little less popular than originally anticipated when they were put into effect at federal law.
Okay. So it's the reverse of what seems to be the jargon on the street.
Mr. Chairman, from the original expectations to today, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gephardt's up there?
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Gephardt, in the fiscal note, is it anticipated that that it's the individual to arrive at the you know, $5,200,000 or $3,700,000, and it's the individual, or is included in there the employer contribution, which is it the employer contribution tax deductible under the federal law? Is that included in there also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, this is loss on the individual income tax only.
Well, Mr. Chair, could I have a clarification then from Representative Knobloch or Representative Wilkins? Because the employer under that provision can also contribute, right? And I'm assuming that if the employer contributes, it's not taxable income. And so where is that estimate in the fiscal note?
Well, Representative Rukavina, Mr. Chairman, I think that that is something that hasn't changed by this law. If you're an employer and you're paying for someone's health insurance as an employee, you can deduct it. If you're giving them money for this purpose as a health insurance item, you can deduct it. I don't believe that that's something that requires a change or a revenue estimate, because that would already be covered by federal law. It's just a question of the employer, how they're paying for the health insurance.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Knobloch,
and Representative Wilkins, when we heard the bill in Commerce Committee, this was going to be very popular, so I'm assuming that you had employers, some employers come to testify, Representative Wilkins, that indicated that they were really going to use this, but I don't know if they were offering health insurance at all at the time. So I would suspect there's some type of fiscal impact, but thank you for the clarification that it's just the individual income tax contribution.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the authors or staff, I don't know who would be best to address it. What's the tax treatment if you do not? I'm extraordinarily healthy. I never use health insurance. Knock on wood. But I go years and years. I accumulate a significant sum in the account. It's obviously my money, and I choose to use it for something else. What's tax treatment at that time? It obviously went in tax-free. When I pull it out and I use it for something other than health care costs, how is it treated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, tax staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but it will be treated as regular income plus, I believe, a 10% penalty. I think that's similar to when you pull it out of your 401k to use it to buy a car or something like that.
Thank you.
Mr. Michael?
I might be corrected.
Mr. Chairman, what Representative Wilkins said is basically correct, except the additional tax is 15%.
10, 15, whatever it takes. Don't do it.
Welcome to the tax committee.
Okay.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions by committee members, is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify either in favor or in opposition to House File 9?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke. And for Representative Wilkin or Knobloch, can you, I know this is the tax committee, but for someone who doesn't follow these health care initiatives as much, you know, in thinking about HSAs, I understand that kind of the guiding principle is if you can introduce the market, you would get consumers to be more cost conscious, and they would make different decisions if they were aware of what the market was doing as it relates to their health care costs. And I know in Representative Wilkin, you handed out a memo here that you talk about the business competitive issue, and I think there's the complexity for Minnesota, if we don't conform, we have like an ongoing problem. But one of the questions I have, this really isn't a tax question, you always hear from the other side who opposes HSAs, that there's really no information on who would actually select to use them. There's a group of folks who will tell you this will be for the young, healthy people, so you'd be segmenting the market, that there'd be some adverse selection going on. Yet I know there's other studies that say that really hasn't happened. It tends to be people who are savers in the first place or are looking for tax preferential treatment. Can either one of you talk about who you think actually is going to use these? I mean, I know it was, I think, the federal government passed in December of 2003, so there's not a lot of information yet. But, you know, who are we trying to assist? Because the tax committee, of course, is going to look at all these conformity issues for the federal update. We've had some discussion here already about The governor is not proposing to conform to the standard deduction for married couples, which is a much more expensive provision than this, but certainly worthy. I know the governor is looking at conforming with the military provisions, the prescription drug provisions, and there's a menu of them. So I think the tax committee, when it ultimately has a target, will have to decide all these different conformity issues. Can you talk about what sort of behavioral change we would expect as a result if the House passed this provision?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski. Actually, let me give you some figures that I've found from different sources. First, Blue Cross Blue Shield did a study on their own consumer-directed health plans, which at the time they were doing the study was mostly HRAs. And what they found was the owners of those that were in consumer-directed had fewer trips to the doctor and fewer visits to the emergency room than members of regular commercial plans. They also used more preventative care and more generic drugs. Again, mostly because they're engaged in that buying decision. Some early numbers from Assurant Health, which is one of the larger providers of HSAs, 29% of HSA purchasers had household incomes of less than $50,000. 27% had a net worth of less than $25,000. 77% of HSA purchasers are families with children. 70% are over the age of 40. So that gets all those numbers get to. It's not just the young and the healthy and the wealthy. Then this is I think one of the more important figures is for Assurant, 43% of their HSA applicants did not have prior health care coverage. 43%. And now in some industry numbers that were put together by an industry association, it's somewhat lower. It might be the target market for Assurant, but for the industry number, that number was around 30%. But still, that's pretty significant people who had not had coverage previously. So that it's addressing the uninsured problem.
Representative Lencheski, have a follow-up? Or okay. Welcome to the tax committee. I'm sorry. Representative Rucavini, you want to jump in here now?
If I didn't make the comment on the last comment about addressing the uninsured problem, because, you know, in this state we've got Minnesota Care, where we moved $700 million, I believe, over the last 3 years out of that fund to pay for other things. And now we're moving people off of Minnesota Care and throwing them in, you know, giving them an option like this. And Representative Lencheski, I have the same questions as you. As somebody making $7 an hour is making $14,000 a year, I don't know how they're going to, where they find the money, unless they really manage their money good, to put it in this fund. And then you have to have a high, I mean, that's what this is all about, these HSAs, is a high deductibility. So you got to pay a lot of money out before you ever get to use, you know, out of pocket. So, you know, I think this is just part of, you know, your ownership society that I hear. It's gone from compassionate conservative now to ownership society. These good catchphrases, where I don't see where anybody can really afford to be part of this ownership society, this bill you have in front of us, because I know people making $6, $7, $8 an hour aren't going to be able to do this.
Representative Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, depending on the Representative Rukavina, depending on the whole profile of that person who is making those low wages, they very well might be eligible at that level for Minnesota Care or for medical assistance. This actually provides a low-cost product to the market that doesn't exist now. And the reason why most people are uninsured is because they can't afford the coverage. If you look at the, I know the chamber has the sheet, I think it's in your packet, they give an analysis. It is less cost for this kind of product than for some of the traditional products that are out there. And you combine this with the other bill that's going through that I'm the author of the flexible benefit plan that doesn't have the burden of a lot of the state mandates. You've got a combination of products that can save you significant money and give you some first dollar coverage that you don't have right now.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rucavino.
Representative Wilkins, we looked at your flexible plan in Commerce Committee, and yeah, if I can offer you an insurance plan that doesn't cover anything unless you die, you took out, I believe, breast cancer wasn't covered in some of those other plans that you talked about, the mandate.
That's not correct.
The state of Minnesota mandate. And they would pick and choose whether what was allowed to be excluded for coverage. You know, sure, you can offer a cheap plan to somebody, but Minnesota Care was a cheap plan based on ability to pay. And you do not qualify for that. Help me out, somebody that sits on Health and Human Service here. But my understanding is the governor's proposal, you just about have to be on welfare and not even working full-time minimum wage, and you don't qualify for coverage.
Representative Rucavino, this is the tax committee. That's not the Health and Human Services committee.
We've got a tax bill in front of us that's going to cost $3.7 million in the out years, or $3 million a year, and I'm wondering who's going to be covered by it. If it's a benefit to the state at all, I would think, Mr. Chair, that we need to save this money and we should let people be back on Minnesota Care, where you and I are right now paying 2%. I know that good health plan you offer your employees, Mr. Chair, you're paying 2% on that into a fund that's supposed to be covering these people already. That's my point.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Rucavino, without getting deeply into the Health and Human Services area, I think you were at the Ways and Means Committee when we found that the cost of Minnesota Care that is paid for by premiums that people pay is only 11% of the actual cost of the plan. But again, this is not a subsidized insurance plan we're talking about here. This is a plan for people in either the private sector or the public sector that are not getting subsidized health insurance, but instead it's a regular health insurance product. It does, as Representative Wilkins said, allow some people who are not able to afford health insurance right now to be able to get health insurance. I don't know that this particular plan is right for every single person. I don't know that any particular plan is right for every single person, but this is another option, and I think that we ought to conform to the federal tax conformity so that we can give those people in Minnesota that are choosing to take this plan, whether they work for the private sector or the public sector, the tax deductions that they would get at the federal level.
Okay, let's hear from our witness.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Jones, here today representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to testify in support of House File 9 and House File 135. Employers desperately need some affordable options in the healthcare marketplace here today. And because this isn't the healthcare committee, let me just give you an idea of what we are seeing happening out there. Healthcare premiums have increased over 58% in Minnesota in the last 5 years. According to the Department of Health, employer-based coverage over that same five-year period has dropped almost 10%. So these costs are having real significant impact in employers' ability to continue to provide affordable coverage. During that same time, we have seen the uninsured rate go up from 5.4% to 6.7%. We need affordable options out there in the marketplace, and as has been said before, this may not be the correct option for everyone, but it clearly is an option that's desperately needed. Some people have said, you know, what's the need? I think the reality is HSAs are here to stay. There was a recent study by Mellon of Minnesota large employers, and 56% of those in that survey expected to offer an HSA option in coverage in 2006. More than 7 of 10 Americans that were surveyed had a favorable opinion of HSAs. The reality is, or the question shouldn't be, are they here? The real question should be, are we going to let Minnesotans take full advantage of this new option and this new law? And I think the purpose here is to try and make sure that we have that option. There's a reason why people didn't buy high deductible plans in the past, and the reality is that the economics didn't make sense. So with the new federal laws, it does make sense to provide that high deductible plan, couple it with an HSA, allow that nest egg to grow over time, and see the benefits. Minnesota is one of only 11 states that does not conform to federal HSA conformity law, and we think we're putting our citizens at a real disadvantage in not being able to take advantage of that. I think also the difficulty in terms of filing different returns that's now required. We do have many people who are utilizing this, and the tax treatment makes it more difficult. I would also mention the retroactive treatment. I think there will be a lot of people this year who will be a little shocked at their inability or the requirement that they're going to have two reforms. Also, anyone who is in a medical savings account and rolled that over into an HSA, they will have to have full tax compliance with that. So I think it's important that the retroactive component of this stay in this bill, and I would urge your support.
Any questions for the witness? Anyone else wishing to testify in favor or in opposition? While you're coming down, I'd just like to recognize members. We have some students here from Southview Middle School in Edina with us today. So welcome, and welcome to the Tax Committee. Hope you enjoy this enthralling debate. Okay, proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Hartwig, and I represent Minnesota Business Partnership. We represent large employers in Minnesota, about 100. The partnership supports the conformity in this bill for HSAs. Healthcare costs and the related issues are a growing concern for employers, as well as for their employees who shoulder a portion of that cost, of their healthcare costs. The partnership believes that health savings accounts does three things that are really important for health care. It gives health care portability to consumers, flexibility to meet the changing demands in the market, and also engages the consumer in the decision making. While we support this proposal, as has been already addressed, this isn't the solution. It's only one tool in the toolbox to help get coverage for more people. Carolyn Jones mentioned the Mellon Financial Corporation study. I apologize, I tried to get a copy of that this morning to bring in for you, but I didn't get it. But their study did say that about a quarter of large employers in Minnesota are offering HSAs as an option, and they do expect that to increase to about 50% in the next year. So this is a real issue for employees, individuals throughout the state, for tax deduction. They can get that tax deduction at the federal level. We're asking that they are able to get that tax deduction at the state level as well. So for those reasons, the partnership urges you to support this bill.
Any questions of the witness? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ma'am, how many of the members of the business partnership are health insurance companies?
I believe we have three.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Edmund,
could you identify them, please?
Blue Cross Blue Shield, Health Partners, and Medica.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you. I'm sorry. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question, whether Ms. Jones from the Chamber, and now you're testifying for the Minnesota Business Partnership, and this isn't specific to this bill, but back to the tax committee again here, which is what we're trying to do. It's not health care, but taxes. There's a menu of federal conformity issues for this legislature to contemplate. And in looking at them, as I've stated, I don't know if you're in the room, but the governor is suggesting we should conform with this provision, the HSAs, the military provision, and the prescription drugs provision. But there's a large set of provisions, far more expensive than the HSAs, quite frankly, that's a dramatic benefit to business. And since you're here and the chamber's here, it's the American Job Creation Act. I'm sure you've heard of it. And I think it's about four or five times as expensive as this federal conformity issue. And Some of them help some of the provisions for federal conformity are for domestic manufacturers, which I think is, you know, a big interest to Minnesota companies. And the other provisions actually help lots of small businesses. And the governor has not suggested, at least in his budget so far, and I'm hoping that maybe Representative Krenke will want to do that in his omnibus tax bill. But he has not brought forward those initiatives for Minnesota business. Can you comment on your feeling about, you know, whether the partnership or the chamber or any business groups you work with, will you be working with the governor to encourage him to conform to these provisions, which are actually more directly beneficial to business?
Ms. Hartwick?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lynchewski, I am not familiar with the American Jobs Creation Act. I would say that the health savings account tax conformity probably is a relatively small conformity cost compared to others, and I do think that there is, speaking from a health policy position, not necessarily tax policy, which I apologize, I'm not as up on. It has direct effects on health, engaging consumers in their health care, and it does have a relatively small cost. And in the budget crisis that we're in right now, we recognize that perhaps not everything can be done at this time. I don't have a specific answer as to exactly what the American Jobs Creation Act or some of these other tax conformities, but I will have our tax lobbyists get back to you on this.
Well, thank you, Ms. Hartwig. Chair Krenke, I hope that you will take the time to have us consider all those federal conformity provisions as we move along. I think the number for conforming to everything that the President has offered us is, I think, $86 million a year. And we've already heard some bills, and some of them, there's a lot of them. We've had some discussion of the standard deduction, and now this one today, and there's the Medicare provisions. But I would hope that as we move forward, we'll look at all of them, because they're all targeted to help different groups of people. And I certainly think that the Representative Knobloch and Representative Wilkin are right to try to deal with the HSA issue, because as I look at it, while I'm not convinced it may not help everyone we think it will, but I think the complexity of not conforming is tremendous. I think it's a big problem for the Minnesota tax code year in and year out if we don't, and I think Representative Knobloch addressed some of that. But I do think that the President and Congress has done a lot of other issues that are very important for married couples, for business groups, for our manufacturers, and we haven't discussed conforming to those provisions. So I hope that we will find a way to take a good look at those before we get an omnibus tax bill together.
Mr. Michaels, could you give us just a brief idea of what we would do to the Minnesota individual income tax return form if we don't comply? Since this is the tax committee and we've been talking about health savings account, more about the health of the individuals rather than the tax complexities of the preparers.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think there are probably a number of different ways that you could sort of try to adjust the Minnesota tax system to not conform. The Department of Revenue, in putting out forms for tax year 2004 where we haven't conformed, used a sort of a shortcut approach to that, and it added four lines to the form. That's probably the minimum that you can get by with. If you want to do this in a technically correct way, basically what you would have to do is to add back the deductible contribution in the year made. Then these accounts are going to earn investment income, of course, and under normal income tax principles, that investment income would generally be taxable when it's realized. So there'd be a line where you would add back the investment income. And fortunately, Minnesota doesn't distinguish between types of investment income, so I think that probably could be done with one line. There are certain circumstances where there would be tax-exempt distributions that you would have to, I think, have a subtraction for, because you've added back in. You don't want to sort of double count. And then the third thing is there, or the fourth thing for sure, is that there would be instances where there would be taxable distributions, which is what Representative Atkins was talking about. And of course, because those have already been taxed under this regime where we've added back contributions, taxed the investment income, you'd have to have a subtraction for that. And I think more important, taxpayers would need to sort of be keeping track, a sort of a basis account for these accounts, knowing sort of what their Minnesota basis is, unlike the federal basis, so they'd have to have a whole set of separate Minnesota records to track these HSA accounts as compared with the federal, which where they're just basically almost all tax free unless they're used for non medical purposes.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Okay, further questions by committee members? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the authors. Looking at House File 660, the governor's bill, it shows the fiscal impact there is $10 million over the biennium, and your two bills show it at 8.2. Can you explain the difference in those fiscal notes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, no. Does the governor's only cover health savings accounts? I mean, I know the governor proposal has some other conformity items in it as well. Mr. Wilson tells me, Representative Lanning, that the governor's number is the old number prior to the update for the February forecast, and that the March 7th, 2005 revenue estimate you have here is the correct number.
We're saving money already. Representative Lanning.
Thank you.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, more of a comment. What the real issue that we're struggling with, and we have struggled with for a long time, is that Minnesota uses federal taxable income as a starting off point. And with the great compromise back in 1987 between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan in simplifying the federal income tax, and then the decisions made here in 87, it was a fairly easy thing to do. And one of the things that we've struggled with, I think, during my tenure on the committee is Congress tinkering with the definition of federal taxable income and then basically dumping the problem back to the state legislatures and say, you take care of it. Because then for states that are noted for good tax policy, and this is under any governor or any tax chair or any majority in the House or the Senate, trying to keep the forms as clean as possible. Governor Perpich was a big proponent of that. It causes some difficulties. I remember when half of Social Security became taxable, and it was above the line for federal taxable income purposes, and it became a very difficult vote for some people in order to conform to the idea of federal taxable income. Hopefully that group in Washington that's meeting, chaired by Senators Breaux and Mack, former Congressman Bill Frenzel from Minnesota is one of the seven members on that commission, will take a look at what is federal taxable income and what are some of the problems you're cramming back at the state. All that Representative Knobloch and Wilkin are dealing with here, and I have some bills dealing with it and others have bills dealing with it, are basically the latest enactments of Congress having to deal with the same issue. And how much record keeping are we going to expect individuals to do? Do we expect individuals to be able to fill out the Minnesota income tax return without having to go to a tax preparation professional? Or hopefully even the software has been able to keep up if you want to go buy one of three commercially available products. But these are very difficult issues to deal with. I'll have a bill up tomorrow that I'll be speaking a little bit more about dealing with the same issue. But as much as you may not want to deal necessarily with the health savings account issue, we also have the military pay issue, We have the what has become the annual problem, and I have been somewhat outspoken about this, dealing with expensing. If the feds would just deal with it as an investment tax credit rather than a deduction from federal taxable income, we wouldn't be having to spend our time trying to figure out how we're going to make things easier for the taxpayer to comply with these sorts of changes. They could have the same economic effect doing the same thing. So, you know, I happen to be a pretty big proponent of dealing with federal taxable income. I also happen to be a proponent of health savings accounts. But ultimately, I think that as a committee, and one of the things I was doing at a national level is trying to educate people on the Joint Tax Committee and our congressmen and senators who happen to serve on the appropriate committees of jurisdiction, that what they do at a federal level in a tax area, even though it may sound good and feel good, really has profound effects at the state level when we're in tough economic times and trying to balance budgets and trying to do the right thing. So while I commend Representative Knobloch and welcome for bringing this forward, but we're really dealing here with different sides of a much larger issue that we've been struggling with for the last 10 years on this committee under three or four or even five different tax jurisdictions. Mr. Franke.
Okay, if there's no further questions, the chair will lay over House File 9 and House File 135 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair. Members.
Members, we now have the long-awaited tax incident study that the Department of Revenue will present to us. Welcome, gentlemen. If you'll just once again give us your names for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dick Gephardt. I'm with the Department of Revenue.
Rod Hoheisel, Department of Revenue.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you want to proceed.
Mr. Chairman, we are here to present the results of the Minnesota Tax Incident Study. It's a study that's required by law. It's done every 2 years. The 2005 Minnesota State and Local Tax Incident report was delivered on March the 1st. The base year for the study is calendar year 2002. The report itself, which you should all have copies of, I'm going to work off the presentation materials that you should also have a copy of, looks at not only the effects of the tax system on individuals for 2002, it looks at trends between 1990 and 2002. This is the eighth study that we have prepared and delivered. And it also has estimates for 2007, which looks out into the future and looks at current law. The report includes the 2002, which I mentioned, the estimates for 07. It also has industry detail. It computes effective tax rates by industry sectors. It looks at the portion of the tax system which falls on Minnesota households and looks at what is exported outside of Minnesota. And it also has a distributional analysis by tax type, which looks at basically on an income-by-income basis the households and what types of taxes and how much tax that they pay. This slide basically just gives you an idea of the Minnesota state and local taxes that are included in the report. And you can see across the top, if you look over on the left-hand column, there's about $17.2 billion worth of state and local taxes that are collected and are included in this report. There's about $28 million which are not included. There's a few small taxes which we still haven't included in this report, but we are now up to 99.9% of all state and local taxes that are included in the report. This is basically a quick overview of the methodology that we go through when we look at tax incidents. The first step is to collect the tax by tax and differentiate the tax by whether or not it is paid directly by households or individuals in Minnesota, or whether it's paid by business in Minnesota. There's also a small part of the tax that is paid by non-residents. But basically, using that information, we can compare some analytical things that I will go through in a minute. But the next step in the whole process, then, is to take the taxes that are paid by business, again, and shift those taxes to who really pays that tax. In other words, a business does not pay tax directly. Individuals pay. And so somebody is going to pay that tax, and the shifting part of this study looks at and goes through a methodology of divvying up those business taxes into people who are consumers, capitals, or business owners, or labor. So we actually get at who is paying the taxes in Minnesota, not only those that are paid directly, but those that are paid indirectly, that are initially levied on business. The third step, then, is to take those taxes and to spread those over households by income. And we use a broad definition of income in this study. Again, it's addressed in the report if you want to look at in more detail of the definitions of income, but it looks at not only what is taxable, but what is also not taxable. The non-taxable portions of Social Security, UI, unemployment insurance, those types of things, to get at a broad definition of household income in Minnesota. And you're able then to look at how the tax burden is distributed over these households by income range. So you can compute effective tax rates by different income levels and look at the burden on Minnesota households. This basically is just a snapshot between 2000 and 2002 of taxes that are initially paid either by households or by business. And as you can see, between 2000 and 2002, there is very little change, actually, in the distribution of the breakdown between households and businesses. It's really about 60-40. About 60% is paid directly by Minnesota households and about 40% by business. There's a small portion, $400 million, that are actually paid by non-residents. I think the thing that I would point out on this slide is if you look down at the total between 2000 and 2002, and this is the first occurrence of this type since these studies have started to be done, is we actually collected $17.6 billion in state and local taxes in 2000. And 2002 definitely shows the effects of the recession that was in Minnesota. And we collected $400 million less, $17.2 billion in 2002.
Representative Lenny, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to this slide, the pie chart, I'm struck by the low number on non-residents, and I'm wondering if the household number doesn't include non-homesteaded property owned by non-residents, seasonal recreational property owned by non-residents, and the same for business. I find it hard to believe that non-residents are only paying $400 million in taxes in the state. So are those folks really included in the other two pieces of the pie?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the non-resident piece of that is included here is really made up of three separate pieces, and I'll show you on the next slide here. Basically, the non-resident is the individual income tax individuals who are paying income tax but don't reside in Minnesota. The sales tax, which is comprised basically of visitors or people who are recreating here in Minnesota. And then there is a property tax component of that, and that's the non-resident property owners. That's who is making up this $350 million worth of non-resident tax.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Lanny?
I still find it hard to believe that non-residents are only accounting for $400 million in these revenues. That just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rucavino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I kind of was wondering the same thing as Representative Lanny, but maybe are these taxes, are we looking at here when you say non-residents are paying the business tax? Let's take an industry I know a little bit about, and that is the taconite industry and their $80, $90 million in production tax, which is in lieu of property tax. And isn't that most of that exported? I mean, that tax is spread through their products they sell throughout the country. So is that part of this non-resident $4 billion, or how do you figure that into it? Do you mean to tell me that you think that the 5 million Minnesota residents are paying that $90 million in production taxes and that's assessed to us, when in fact there isn't even any steel made in this state? So I would assume that it's assessed to all their customers across the country or internationally. Am I not tracking this thing right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this breakdown that you're looking at here is basically who is paying the tax initially, not who ultimately pays. And I think what your question is getting at is who really pays that tax. The tax that you're talking about is, in the study we lay that out, is basically 99% of that is exported outside of Minnesota. The industry initially pays it, but the ultimate bearer of the tax burden is outside of Minnesota. So I think that the taconite tax is truly not being paid in this study by Minnesota households.
So they wouldn't be, Mr. Chair, in this pie chart at all that we're looking at, and the one Ms. Representative Lanning was questioning on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, they're not here at this stage. We do get to that, though, after we go through the shifting assumptions that I was talking about earlier.
Let's continue.
Again, this slide is showing the taxes imposed on businesses, households, and non-residents, but this looks at the state and local business taxes by industry. And you can see here, again, the industries that are paying these taxes initially. This is who is legally liable for these taxes. And you can see that you can break them down, but basically the largest sector paying tax in Minnesota in terms of dollars is trade, transportation, and utilities. It's a very large sector in Minnesota. Financial activities are also bearing a large dollar amount of the tax burden in Minnesota. But you can look down and see, get an idea of the industries that are paying tax from a legal liability point of view. This next slide is looking at the effective tax rates by industry. And again, this is before shifting. This is who is legally liable for these taxes. And it's a breakdown and a computation of an effective tax rate that looks at the taxes that are being paid by these industries divided by their contribution to gross state product, which is the analogous piece of the gross domestic product that I'm sure everyone is familiar with at the national level. But gross state product is a value-added concept. It basically measures the size of an industry's contribution to the state of Minnesota's economy. And you can see here that the effective tax rates are in the 2-3, in some cases 4-5% range. The exception to that is the mining industry, which does have a high effective tax rate initially, based on the taxes that it pays versus its contribution to the state economy. Step two, then, is the estimate of the $17.2 billion that the state and local governments collect in Minnesota that is actually borne by Minnesota households and the amount that is exported. Again, the dollar amounts that are levied on business, a portion of those are shifted to Minnesota households, and a good portion of those are shifted outside of the state of Minnesota. And as you can see, this breakdown for 2002 shows $2.8 billion, or 16% of the tax burden levied by state and local governments in Minnesota is shifted outside of the state of Minnesota. $14.4 billion is levied on Minnesota households. Uh, This, again, gives you an idea of the amount of dollars that are exported or shifted once they are levied on the businesses in Minnesota. For individual income tax, again, it's primarily levied on Minnesota households. The amount that's exported is equal to the non-resident portion. But for corporate income tax, you can see that a good portion is shifted outside or exported outside of Minnesota. So $297 million of the total corporate income tax collected is borne by Minnesota households, while $263 million is shifted outside of Minnesota. Sales tax, almost $800 million is shifted outside of Minnesota, that is paid by businesses here. And property tax, $1.2 billion is actually shifted outside of Minnesota. In total, the $14.4 million is borne by Minnesota households, but $2.8 billion of it is shifted outside of the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Kiphart, do we have any comparisons with other states in terms of this type of information, i.e., the percentage of taxes that are borne or the amount of taxes that are borne by the state residents versus shifted or exported?
Mr. Chairman, there are a few other studies that are done. They're done irregularly that I'm aware of by other states, not regularly as this one is done. There was recently an incident study completed by Wisconsin where they basically looked at their tax system. So there is some comparisons there you can get with the state of Wisconsin.
So we have no, I mean, for example, other states that I think of that would export a substantial amount of their tax burden, say Hawaii or Alaska. We don't have any information to compare what they do in this arena versus where Minnesota ranks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Thank you.
The slide on page 11 starts discussing the basis for the distributional analysis of the study results for Minnesota households. And as you see in the table, the results are studied by what we refer to as or call population deciles. And each decile includes 10% of all of Minnesota's households. So each decile for the base year in our study of 2002, as you can see, includes 234,000 households. In the table, you can see the income ranges that are associated with each decile, and also in this table, the share of total household income and taxes that are paid is also shown. So going to the table, you can look at, for example, the first decile, which includes the lowest incomes up to $8,354. The table shows that the first decile includes 1% of the total household income overall, but pays 1.6% of the taxes. In contrast, the 10th decile, which would be the highest 10% of income-earning households, the income range there starts at $102,400 and above. The 10th decile households comprise or have 38.8% of the total household income, but also pay a similar amount, 36.8% of all the taxes in the study.
Mr. Chair.
Excuse me one second. Representative Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess bringing up comparisons, do you have any on where this, I know we saw rankings, but not presented quite this way. Say if you were looking at the 9th and 10th decile, that 53% as to how Minnesota compares nationally with these brackets.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of any 50 state studies that would do that. There are two or three other states that have studies similar to our incident study, but I've never personally or we've never looked at a comparison of that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's continue then.
The next slide looks at the final step that has to do with allocating incident results to households, and that is making estimates of the incidence of each tax by decile. and then calculating effective tax rate. And you'll see on this figure the effective tax rate for each of the deciles. The total overall state and local total for 2002 is 11.3%. And you'll notice that the effective tax rates show a little bit of increase or progressivity in the lower to middle income deciles. For example, the effective rate in the second decile is 10.5%. It grows to 12% in the seventh decile, and there is a some decline in the 10th decile. I'll note at this point also, and we've talked about this before, the first decile, you'll note that has a rather high effective tax rate. That's basically because the data is rather limited at that level. The effective rate is unusually high due to some cases where taxpayers, for example, report business losses, but may be down there, but that tends to distort that effective tax rate. So essentially we look at the others as being more in the norm here. The next slide.
Excuse me, just one second. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, is there a way or has there been studies done to estimate or determine how much people in different deciles are taxed outside of Minnesota? You often hear that, you know, the higher earners have the ability to purchase homes and pay taxes elsewhere. I'm wondering how much tax we're losing from certain deciles. Is there anything out there, any data or any studies that have been done that cross lines of states?
Unfortunately, not that I'm aware of. So our study here, for example, focuses on Minnesota taxes that Minnesotans ultimately pay in the state. And we talked about earlier, some of our taxes are exported to other other states and non-residents pay them. Also, yes, we have residents who are involved in businesses or activities in other states that pay taxes, but again, I'm not aware of any studies that really looks at all of that across all the 50 states.
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, to the folks from revenue, if you typically we see a chart also, but I don't see it in here where you divide the deciles up by income instead of population. And then what would your picture be as far as your effective tax rate by decile when you divide it up into whether it's 12 billion or 11 billion or whatever that is? Do you have a slide like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, that information is included in a section in the report. I guess if we could find the table that is included on. We don't have that in the report here. In comparison to the distribution of rates by population deciles, what it would do would be to have, if you divide it up by 10 increments of income instead of households, you'd have a lot more households at the bottom end and a lot fewer at the top. So what it would do would be to show the effective rate over the 10 deciles of income declining at a much greater slope or degree. And perhaps we can find that in the report here.
Oh, Mr. Chair, we typically did get that information when the revenue would do the slideshow by income deciles besides population deciles, but I don't see it in this slide, and I think it, you know, for the members, it does have a much more, I guess, chilling effect when you figure that there's probably 900,000 households at the bottom decile that live on the same amount of money as 7,000 or 8,000 or 10,000 at the top.
In our report that's rather extensive, starting on page one, there is a section on additional results that talks about the presentation of income decile information. So the table would be on page 53, and the effective tax rates are on page 54. So what that shows in comparison to these rates, for example, I'll concentrate on the top end, the 9th and 10th deciles, shows 11.7 and 10.7% as an effective tax rate. The distribution based on income is 10.7 in the ninth decile, dropping to 8.5% in the 10th decile.
So, Mr. Chair and members, if I'm looking at this right on page 54, then the 10,874 households that are lucky enough to live on the same $12.7 billion as the 903 households at the bottom pay an effective rate on all Minnesota taxes of 8.5%, and those poor people at the bottom pay 11.3%. Is that right?
And Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, those figures are correct. In fact, in a few slides, we're going to talk a little bit more, and there's a little more information about the impact that high incomes of effective tax rates due to economic trends and so forth. Yes, that's correct under this alternative presentation.
All right, let's, unless there's additional question on this, let's continue.
Page 13 shows effective tax rates for various categories of taxes, the individual income tax, the sales tax, homeowner property tax, and business taxes. And as you can see on this chart or slide, the income tax is really the only progressive tax in the system. As you see, it increases steadily up to about 5.5% in the 10th decile. The other taxes are basically regressive. However, they do vary quite a bit in the level and degree of regressivity in each. The next slide shows some information about contribution to Minnesota's relatively proportional tax system by tax. And essentially, these amounts shown are based on an index that's calculated for each tax that is weighted by how either progressive or regressive each tax is. And it shows, as you can see, on the progressive side versus the regressive side, that the progressivity of the income tax, and then to some extent that we have the property tax refund program, really comes close to offsetting the regressivity of all the other taxes in the system overall.
Representative Lynchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that slide on the progressive regressive taxes, we had some discussion earlier in committee, and not specific to the incidence tax, but when we looked at the gaming proposals that the governor had before us, a number of us, Representative Dorman was one of the members, and I was, and I'm not sure all. We were all asking about kind of how did the governor get to the dollar figure for his note, and then we had a discussion about incidence, about how gambling taxes fall on people. And I know that people know it's a regressive tax, but just in the incidence study, you have on this slide, you know, other consumption and other. The only place I even see gambling taxes in the study is on page 40, and the way I read that Suits Index is it's the second most regressive tax in the state of Minnesota, second only to cigarettes. And when you have this chart in front of us on page 14, are these other consumption, does that include gambling, or is it in the other group? Where does gambling fall in this list of regressive taxes?
Well, the gambling taxes would be included in the consumption tax category, but they'd be under excise taxes. The amount of the tax is small enough that for the tables we produce, they're kind of lumped together in a category for excise taxes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynchesky.
Can I just ask that I receive, and maybe the whole committee would be interested, the incidence of gambling taxes broken down by deciles. I know you have it on some of the major other taxes, but is it possible for the department to show us by decile how gambling taxes would play out?
Yes, we have that information.
Okay. Thank you.
I can share that with you. I'll point out, I guess I mentioned excise taxes as a separate category for other state taxes, so gambling would be included in other as opposed to excise.
Thank you.
Did you want them by population or by income decile?
Both. I just think, Mr. Chair, it'll be an ongoing part of the discussion, and something we should know.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up with Representative Lincheski's idea, I think if we're going to talk about different proposals being offered by different sides of the aisle or both sides of the aisle, we should probably get the same information for the regressivity on cigarette taxes at the same time and add that into the mix.
Do you have an additional study you want, Representative?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I appreciate the efforts that have been done, and I believe that if we can get that gambling incidence study, that will be helpful. On that note, however, I just wanted to ask a question of you, Mr. Chair. We've got, on Friday, as I understand it, we just got notice that the gaming division is going to take up the governor's gaming bill, the casino bill, I believe even slots and bars. And I'm not aware of any other fiscal stop, and I know that's of great concern to you that those bills would be making, with the exception of this committee. There's any number of references in those bills. I know in the governor's bill, for example, and Mr. Michael was kind enough to give us a memo on this. There's sales tax exemptions. There's property tax exemptions. In the other bill, with respect to the Racino, there's imposition of new taxes, or the word is actually used in several sections. There's new tax exemptions. There's new limitations on political subdivisions' ability to impose certain taxes. Rather than change that Friday hearing into an awfully long and drawn-out discussion on the fiscal impact and the soundness of those proposals, just wanted your assurance that those will be making a visit here in the Tax Committee when we can talk to them about the various new taxes and exemptions that they intend to impose or relieve certain folks from imposing.
Well, as Representative Atkinson, I have stated in the past, it would be my intention that any gaming proposal would likely come to the Tax Committee. It would be certainly my request to have the bill come here, unless for some reason I can be dissuaded that it shouldn't come here. But as I've also stated in the past, the bills sometimes find their ways to different jurisdictions than what the authors or the chairs want. So, but I would presume that, number one, on Racino, that legislation would also need to go to the State Government Finance Committee, because as I understand it, in the way the bill's been drafted in the past is that the state lottery would operate or have a jurisdictional presence with regard to the operation of the slots at Canterbury, and that falls under the purview of the State Government Finance Committee. I presume that the state lottery is going to be looking for an additional, I mean, either appropriation or percentage of the proceeds to operate those slots. So, but other stops, again, with the bills, I'm maybe they won't get out of the first committee.
Well, and
so, okay. Sometimes people are always plotting and thinking about where the next stop is, and sometimes you got to make it past first base before you get to second.
No. Well, I note that the gay marriage, two of our members from the DFL contingent have been scheduled out of town that day by Representative Johnson, who chairs the Civil Law and Elections group. So I don't know if the goal was to fix the fight or not, but I believe that our contingent will be cut in half, and I suspect that, I don't want to say the fix is in, but I suspect that it may get out of committee on Friday if we're forced to hear that bill on Friday.
Are you intimating that the gaming committee would, post the odds and...
I one never knows what Vegas will post, but I might add I Googled myself the other day, Joe Atkin, and you know what popped up? I'm a bookmaker in Vegas. So if this doesn't work out, I think
there's
I
a career waiting for you in Vegas. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your assurances. I based on the fact your point was that it's likely, I assume you have requested and will continue to request it,
In view of your comments, I think we probably will look into quite deeply the finances that are being pitched as part of the Racino and the governor's bill.
We've also requested that the toilet tax come to the tax committee, and we'll see. We'll see how we do in that venue as well. So, back to tax incident studies.
The next slide shows some history of effective tax rates by decile over the course of a number of years, 1990 to 2002. And we can distinguish the different lines there. A couple of trends I'll point out. Overall, effective tax rates have come down somewhat from the 90s due to tax changes and income growth. And I'll talk a little bit more about in a few minutes. You see a little bit of a trend compared to some of the very early studies where it did, where the rates were more proportional across deciles, that there is now some increase from the lower to middle deciles that have showed up in recent studies. And also there's a phenomenon with the 10th decile where the rate has come down in recent years, especially primarily due to income growth at the high end. This slide shows the history of rates overall by year of study, and you can see that the highest effective tax rates occurred in the mid-90s, particularly 1994. The overall rate was 12.9%, 12.7% in 96, and in the last couple of studies, 2000, it was 11.2% and very close for 11.3% for 2002. The next slide we have shows some information on effective tax rates for the top 5%, top 1% of Minnesota households compared to overall rates. And on this figure, you can see for the top 5 and 1%, the difference in effective tax rate is greatest in 1998 and in the year 2000. And in studying this somewhat, the reason that shows up for those years is those are the years where we had really high or fast income growth, obviously particularly at the top end in the top deciles. And what we ascertained from this information is that in periods of really high income growth, quite a few of our taxes, for example, sales taxes and property taxes, don't keep pace with higher income growth. So what that means is that the effective tax rate would naturally come down due to that. And again, you can see it's a few studies ago, we were trying to understand some of this, and now that we have a little bit of history, you can really see a marked change that happened in 1998 and 2000, and that part of that in our analysis is due to substantial income growth that just occurred in those years. The next slide provides some information about the SEEPS index, which is the measure that we use to compare the degree of regressivity, progressivity, or proportionality of a tax. And the SEEPS index measure ranges from -1 to +1. If -1 of the tax would be totally regressive, that is, if all the tax would be paid by the lowest income group, if 0 if the tax would be proportional, and +1 if the tax is totally progressive or it's all paid by the highest income group. And we can see over time looking at this history that the tax system became slightly more regressive overall in the 90s and a little less regressive since then in the last couple of study years. But overall it's relatively close to proportional. The next slide, page 19, starts to look at changes between the results we've talked about in 2002 compared to our projections for 2007. And one thing that we see in regards to the initial burden of the tax that's paid by households is that that's projected to increase a little bit. It was 58.7% for 2002, and that share will increase to projected 61.1% for 2007. Conversely, the business share is declining, and there are a few reasons that are noted on the bottom that account for that shift to households. Number one, the state property tax levy is just limited to growth and inflation. Probably more importantly, the property tax during these years really reflects a very rapid growth in residential market values that factors into these results quite a bit that we found. The next slide looks at changes in effective tax rates by industry, again from 2002 to 2007. Some of the reasons we've talked about earlier, the rate is expected to decline a little bit. You can see the amounts for the different industrial categories that are shown, and again, some of the similar reasons for the change or shift. The property tax for the state levy is limited to inflation only. But in some categories of taxes, particularly the sales tax, the economic growth has been in and will continue to be in the direction of largely untaxed services that accounts for some of that. The next slide shows the change in effective tax rates from 02 to 07 by decile, and you can see our projected effective tax rate for 07 is 11.1, which would be down a little bit from the 11.3% in the 2002 base data. Essentially, we're looking at the period of where, although there have been a few changes in the tax system, some of this was accounted for by income growing more rapidly than the tax system, what I mentioned a little bit earlier. In regards to a projection for the suits index, we were looking at the suits index based on our analysis being really close to what it is for 2002. System is expected to become just slightly more regressive, a suits index of minus 0.03 versus the current minus 0.02. The next several slides look at...
Representative Markford.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I was just wondering if the chart on 21 and 22 are related at all, and is that if the regressivity increased a little bit into the forecast on 22, and also deciles 3, 4, and 5 tend to go up. Does that have to do with the property tax increases that you alluded to a little bit earlier, or doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe our forecast here would include all the taxes, but one thing that we would note is that the property tax system is probably accounts for the largest percentage growth compared to income or sales tax are growing much less than average. So that difference in the rates at the lower deciles could certainly be due to that. However, we think that the income growth that's coming back, 2002 was such a low recession year, that part of this certainly is the overall reduction in the effective tax rate is due to the fact that incomes are growing at a faster pace and that sales tax payments and property tax payments are less than that. So that makes a difference on the final calculation of the rate. But again, our look at recent studies has told us that changes in income, economic trends, the economy sometimes plays a much bigger part in terms of some of these results than do just, you know, smaller changes in taxes.
Thank you.
These slides that are coming up start to look at the various taxes and effective tax rates in different categories. The one on page 23 shows effective tax rates comparing 02 and 07 for the individual income tax. The overall rate is expected to be the same on that, just a little bit of difference in the distribution. On the next slide that shows the sales tax, there we get into a couple of areas where there is some change that will show up. You can see that for sales, the state sales tax, the rate is expected to decline from the current 2.9% to 2.5%. And the reason there is that the overall sales tax is really growing much slower than the average, and part of that is the fact that services aren't taxable, and that's a growing share of the economy. Going on to the next figure shows the property tax information, and opposite the effect of the sales tax, there's higher total growth in the property tax system, so the rate is expected to increase from 2.5% to an effective tax rate of 2.8% in 2007, and that essentially just is a function of the higher growth that is expected in that part of the system. We look next at the two slides, the homeowner property tax, both gross and net of property tax refunds. And probably the bigger component of the change in property tax lies within the homeowner system. The rate for the gross property tax expected to increase from 1.5% to 1.9%. And again, our analysis of that showed very, very high growth in home market values statewide. It's very significant that drives some of these changes within the property tax. The final figure shows the business tax comparison for 02 and 07, and for some reasons that we pointed out earlier, that effective tax rate is expected to decrease a little bit for total business taxes. And then finally, the very last page has a summary of a number of the things we mentioned, which maybe I can run through. Looking at the changes that occurred from 2000 to 2002, overall, the household income, because of the recession year and as well as total tax collection, fell between 2000 and 2002. The shares of business versus household taxes remained rather steady in that period. The overall tax system became slightly less regressive in 2002, but the effective tax rate rose just a little bit to 11.3%. Looking overall at the history from 1990 to 2002, again, the base data in the study for 2002 reflecting the recession really has an impact on rates and distributions. It was really a marked change from the high growth in incomes that were in the previous few years. Effective tax rates peaked in 94 and have generally fallen ever since until 2002, combination of some of the tax law changes that were made and economic trends. Minnesota trended toward being slightly regressive in the more regressive a little bit in the 90s, but it's since stabilized. And that final point under the history, the rapid growth in the 90s really exceeded the tax system's ability to remain proportional as it had been when we first started the studies going back to 1990. Looking ahead to 2007, economic growth is expected to lower the overall effective tax rate a little bit. The overall tax system is expected to trend for slightly a little bit more regressive system, and the initial burden of taxes will shift to households to a little bit of a degree and away from business.
Are there any final comments or questions of the people from the department? If not, gentlemen, thank you very much for your work on the incident study and the presentation this morning. The Representative Simpson, would you care to move the minutes from the previous meeting?
So moved, Chair Franke.
Any additions, corrections, deletions? If not, all those in favor of the minutes as written? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed? Minutes are adopted. Meetings adjourned, members.